You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Feels Like Weezer, where we're going track by track, song by song, through all of Weezer's catalog, from Blue to Van Weezer, and beyond. I'm Eric Nash from Almost Famous Minute.
And I'm Zach Fracking-Smith. You can follow me on Twitter at The Informal Log.
Yeah. How you doing, Zach?
Oh, man. I am so excited. Mm-hmm. We're actually going to talk about a good Weezer album. After these past two, I'm really excited to talk about Maladroit, just as a whole. Mm-hmm. Oh, did you mean, like, personally? Oh, I'm doing fine.
yeah, man, I'm ready to nerd out about Weezer. Of course I'm all right.
Yeah, so what are we talking about today, Eric?
Yeah, this is the Maladroit special, as we've been calling them, at the beginning of these each album. And I think we're going to hear a good bit from you, but I'll chime in when I have... A little something to add, I think.
Oh, for sure. I want to address something right off the top. Some people pronounce it Maladroit.
Oh, wow.
I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Because one, sounds pretentious. And two, this is America. We speak American here. That's not... Zach, cut that joke. That wasn't a good joke. But no, I think Maladroit is the common pronunciation, but mm-hmm. some people, usually like French people, French Canadians, you know, I've heard Maladroit, which I just don't think is right. So, and me as the librarian of the group, I know these things, I guess. Mm-hmm. So have you heard much of Maladroit before we started working on this?
Yeah. I definitely tried to come up with pretty rough years, you know, because I'm pretty sure I had listened to it, you know, like say once or twice, roughly a couple of years after it had come out, you know, not right away. I just wasn't into Weezer as much as mm-hmm. I was back in the 90s and then now. So around like 2004, 2005 probably. And just, you know, it was like a library borrow or something probably.
Yeah.
Very likely. But then I'm pretty sure I got around to buying it. I picked it up, I think, in like maybe around 2012-ish. You know? Mm-hmm. And from then on, you know, for an album that I'd heard, you know, apparently it's one that like maybe like did the worst sales wise.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've heard recently in some researching, but back then, you know, I mean, it's possible I kind of looked it up then too, and it's like, but you know, it's just like, I mean, it was just a good price in a bargain bin, you know.
Oh, for sure. My copy was $3.50.
Yeah, wow.
I remember the price, but I took off the sticker, but I do have a used sticker on here as well. Mm-hmm. I originally did not like this that much, but this was during my, like, oh man, the only good Weezer is Blue and Pinkerton and everything else sucks. Mm-hmm. And then also during my, I think Ratitude is a good album phase, which I did have. I will be upfront about that, but, and I don't know why I slept on it for so long, because I started listening to it about, like a year or two ago. And I'm like, oh man, this album just slaps. It is so good. And, you know, I think honestly, because I'm like, oh, I haven't listened to it a whole lot. I might as well put it in my CD player in my car when we started working on Pinkerton, me and you. And it's like, I just took it out of my CD player today. So it's been in there for a good, like, 5 months, I think. Yeah, just about. So I really enjoy this album, and I'm really excited to talk about it and, you know, kind of show you that I do actually like Weezer, contrary to popular belief.
Yeah, my doubts have been forming about...
I don't think he's really a fan of Weezer.
It's like...
No, you could better...
If he keeps this up...
Well, and the main reason I like this is because it's a huge departure from the Green Album. You know, the Green Album was really polished and, you know, poppy, and this is, you know, we're kind of seeing the grunge of Pinkerton. All the songs are darker and heavier, and you know, that's what I really like about it. You know, and it's produced by them, you know, or as unproduced as they call it, so.
Well, and the other thing, the one big kind of takeaway I'd like to, you know, before we then go in the song by song of what we're going to do, my one last kind of takeaway, though, is that, I mean, yeah, I understand what you're saying there about, you know, less polished and not so poppy and a little bit darker, but also I think it's just got a bit more of a variety of some songs. I mean, it's not like any are all that poppy, but there are certainly a couple that are a little lighter and a little, you know,
it has highs and lows. Side.
Yeah, right.
Like an album should have.
Right. Yes.
Like, and it's just like, if you were to do like a Weezer-thon and you were to just go through all the songs, like, I don't know, like some weird podcast would do. But like after you hit Green, it sounds like a completely different band from on Maladroit. And I think a lot of this is, it really is the spiritual follow up to Pinkerton. You know, because Green is, I think is Green is kind of where we see Weezer now. Like, I think if Green was released now, it would do very, very well instead of just very well. I really think that this should have been...
people are just more in tune with kind of, oh, okay, this is what we're going to get.
Right. And I think I've talked about this before. Like, the true order, the true release order of Weezer albums should have been Blue, Green, Maladroit, then Pinkerton. And I know I just said it's the spiritual successor, but hear me out. You know, because with Blue, they hit their big success. Green is incredibly polished and, you know, kind of what the studio execs want. And then you kind of start to see that harder, darker edge with Maladroit, and then you get into Pinkerton. I don't think it would be as much of a jump from Blue to Pinkerton as it would be from Maladroit to Pinkerton. One that especially back up to Green right after Pinkerton, you know, and I say that because Make Believe is next, but, you know, which is similar to Green, not as bad, but similar.
Now what if you reversed Blue and Green though?
What if I don't think they'd be successful. I think if they released Green first, it wouldn't be. But we still have the same end result. Is that what you're saying?
Kind of the same okay. Overall flow. Just the yes. Flow is more, I think, in line with what I think you're trying to get at.
Right.
But I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, what you're saying is successful. Yeah.
Right. And to talk about some band about bugs, the Beatles, there's, you know, they start with those really poppy, happy love songs. And then, you know, it really does kind of go into a weird direction from there, you know? So I guess we could almost say, if that was the case, if it was Green, Blue, Maladroit, Pinkerton, we would kind of follow the same arc. But I don't think there's anything really stand out in Green that could propel them to the level that they were. You know, I think Island in the Sun and Hashpipe were only good because all the other stuff was really good before. And that all is to say that we really see Weezer go into a direction you know, that they are today with Maladroit, starting with this, where, you know, you kind of veer into them, him actually, Rivers, mm-hmm. actually, you know, interacting with fans, you know, and trying to hear what they want as opposed to just being Rivers, you know? So before we really get into the album, we should probably talk about the personnel changes here. Mikey Welsh has, at this point, he left the band in August of 2001, and he checked into a psychiatric hospital in Boston. Carl Koch, unofficial fifth member of Weezer, would periodically update fans on the website, you know, letting them know that, you know, Mikey's, this is kind of what's going on. But after they hired Scott, they just kind of, Koch was just like, okay, what's going on between, well, this is a quote here, what's going on between Mikey and Weezer is a private matter as it has been since day one, and there will be no further announcements, news, or speculation in this space unless and until everyone involved is ready to make any statements on the matter. How do you feel about that?
You know, I mean, it's just, it seems like it's a big matter of, you know, some people have some issues, and whether it really is just Mikey or maybe Rivers in his ways, mm-hmm. especially back then. You know, it's just, you know, what, you know, we just want to keep them happy.
Yeah.
So we're going to shut up.
Yeah, right. And I get that. I just, if I was a fan and I was really worried about Mikey,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. If I was a fan of Weezer, you know, at the time, I just kind of feel like that the timing on that is a little weird. I wish mm-hmm. they would have maybe waited a little bit longer after hiring Scott, or, you know, did it before the hiring. Instead of just like, okay, we have a new bassist, bye. We're done with you, Mikey. But, so a lot of people, like, nobody really knew the whole story with Mikey. But in 2007, he gave the following statement. This is a big quote. You ready for it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Quote, basically a lifetime of doing drugs and being undiagnosed as having bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and borderline personality disorder caught up with me when I was 30 years old. At the beginning of a three-month European tour with Weezer, I started slowly falling apart. Without getting too graphic, by the time the tour was winding up, my weight had gone down to 140 pounds, I'm 6'2", and mentally completely wiped out. When I returned to the States, my family had made plans for me to see a psychiatrist in Boston. First, though, we had to play a few dates around the U.S. and perform on The Tonight Show, which ended up being my last performance with Weezer. By the time I got to Boston, I was having a complete nervous breakdown. It ended with a severe suicide attempt and overdose. I was found and rushed to the hospital, where I had come to within minutes of my heart completely stopping. I was in a coma for a few days and woke up in a lockdown psychiatric ward, end quote. Which, this is, you know, it's a big deal, you know, and... I guess this is my point to say, mental health is just as important as physical health. Yeah. So please, talk to a therapist. Get on medication. I did it, and it's great. But after that, he did, eventually he checked out of the psychiatric ward. Yeah. And he started a band with a guitarist from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, Nate Albert, which... Yeah, I like Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
Well, I didn't get that impression, though.
What? Wait, what?
I didn't get that
impression, though. What
impression? The impression that
I got. Oh, my God. Oh. Okay.
Okay, let's go on.
Thanks for... All right. Pack it in. We're done. We hit... peak dad joke. It's over. Thanks everybody for you know, what's really funny was right before we started recording, Eric was like, you know, I've got a few things to put in there, you know, it's not just gonna be, and I'm like, okay, great, you know, and I was expecting, you know, like hard hitting you know,
well, that wasn't journalistic a one, takes.
It wasn't a planned one? That's no. even more... Oh, my God. That's so great. Oh, wow. So, oh, my God. Okay, so what he really liked about it was that he could play music, quote, without a major label idiot standing over your shoulder, quote. But later he retired in order to become a full-time artist, like paint stuff. He, you know, actually had his art featured on a line of snowboards from Burton Snowboards, which I'm sure you know all about, right, Eric?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Big snow, big snowbird. You know, you like a... No, that's when old people moved to Arizona.
I've never snowboarded, and the one time I snow skied, when I was like 11, I fell down a lot. Didn't enjoy it.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Sounds like my life. So yeah. I tried snowboarding once.
Yeah.
Not good. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Now, before we kind of continue,
I'm not doing this ever again. I don't like having my feet controlled that much. Anyway. That's not important.
You know, you know, do we, you know, it's do we want to, you know, say anything about his death? I mean, I don't know how much I can't quite recall how much we might have referenced it prior. But
well, I know that we kind of talked about it a few times. But yeah, we can get into it.
I mean, yeah, just as a little insert, you know, mm-hmm. you know, unless we were ever planning on for some reason coming back to it, but it's just hard to imagine why we would.
Well, it was one of those things where, like, with kind of where I was ending it, it's like that's about around this time.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, but I'd be fine talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just that it was 2011. That was quote, that last big quote was 2007. Mm-hmm. And talking about, you know, back in 2001, in the period that we're in. But, you know, yeah, in 2011, and, you know, seemingly, you know, initially, you know, the you know, his own Facebook page, you know, whoever was doing that, his wife apparently had a wife and a kid or two, I think, mm-hmm. you know, they or someone for them, you know, posted on his page that he had died of heart failure, but, you know, it ended up being, of course, drug related, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Heroin overdose, seemingly. But, you know, then the most more crazier thing is that apparently a couple weeks prior on Twitter that he had posted, he predicted his death.
Yeah.
Essentially. Amazing. I mean,
he tweeted.
Know, but, you know, is that really a prediction, or is it, you know, is it, you know.
Of a version of a suicide note, essentially. You know. I mean, I don't want to speculate, but the timing is, you know. Scary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you know, he was a really successful musician and you know, artist and everything, and but unfortunately he just, you know, couldn't keep up with it, and mm-hmm. You know, took his own life or just died of an overdose. I mean, it's again not my place to speculate, but you know, and that's, you know, he was only 40. You know, that's
than I am.
Young. Oh, well, yeah. Now we know Eric is 45. three. I know how to do math, Eric.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But he did have a pretty good relationship with Weezer still, you know, mm-hmm. like it wasn't like they kicked him out and then, you know, it was like, okay, bye. But, you know, in 2005, they played a show, and he dedicated Hashpipe to him, and then, you know, he was called on stage and everything. In 2010, he was at a Weezer concert, and Scott Schreiner and Pat Wilson organized a last-minute switcheroo, that's another quote, and pulled him on stage to play bass during Hashpipe. To the surprise of Wizard Cuomo. And then Welsh said, fortunately, they picked the one Weezer song I still remember how to play. And then he also played shortly before his death in 2011. He played the Sweater song with Weezer and the Flaming Lips. So, you know, fortunately, they did have still a pretty good relationship. You know, it's just, it's sad that, you know, it had to end that way. You know, he was a good part of the band, and, you know, he's definitely missed. Mm-hmm. And that he didn't really get to shine much, you know, with how the Green Album took, you know, turned out. There's not really a whole lot of bass driven songs like we have in Blue and Pinkerton. So his replacement, Scott Schreiner, born in Toledo, Ohio. Fun fact. Did you know that, Eric?
No.
How far is Toledo from where you are?
It's like a three and a half hour drive north.
Oh, gotcha. Well, see, I just imagine that it's all one, you know, like one interstate, like how most people think of Iowa. It's just like, oh, everything's like 10 minutes away from each other. But he's the full-time bassist. He's an ex-Marine. And Weezer wasn't his first gig. He was part of the backing group for Vanilla Ice, which I think is really important to note.
I assume he was playing bass guitar for them.
Right.
So, of course, the...
And it's a pretty important, you know, yes, bass line.
Right. Dun.
Which, you know...
Right.
Even though it took me a minute to think, like, why? Where's the joke here? Another really important thing that I need to talk about is that he guest starred with a band called the Scrantones in at the 2007 The Office convention, and he played Radiohead's Creep with Craig Robinson singing, which I think is just a wonderful fact, and I'm very happy that I continue to read on his Weezerpedia page. So he, at his first show with Weezer, he played at our good friend's KROQ, their Inland Invasion. He was attacked on stage by a former bandmate of his. Like, what? That's nuts! But he continued to play, and he is still with Weezer today. So the bass position in Weezer is definitely not cursed, as I'm sure that people thought in 2001. Like, oh, how long is this guy going to last? But, yeah, I like Scott. I think he's got a really great, you know, he's got a fun personality, and I think he was a good addition to the band. Mm-hmm. So, on to the album itself. So, in the later half of 2001, Rivers was writing so many songs, like, just boom, 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 boom. And they could, like, play an actual live show without playing any of the, you know, pre-recorded tracks, you know, from like Blue, Pinkerton, or Green. I was really proud. We write this ahead of time, but I really want to read this exactly how I wrote it. So, he was high on Nietzsche at the time and vowed to make Weezer the greatest rock band of all time. See, now that I read it out loud, I realized that I had time and time in the same sentence. It's garbage. This is a garbage sentence. I was so happy. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is great. And then I'm like, oh, crap. No, that's not good writing. Oh, my God. So what he did in typical Rivers fashion was he just took complete control of the band, like more so than usual. He's just like, I'm doing everything. Bye. Which made, obviously, fans and the band a little nervous, but so they started working on Maladroit, and so they did three or four recording sessions before, and then an album really kind of started to make itself. But because of how Rivers acts towards his fans, he decided that since it's declining, since the relationship's not doing well, he's going to take the actual meat of the album and give it to the fans and kind of have them act as producers. You know, they knew the band, they weren't motivated by money, you know, and they're happy to interact with Rivers or anyone, you know, within the band. And this was when Rivers took up his infamous name, Ace. Do you know much about Ace?
Besides what I, as you just alluded to, there is the thing you've written up and
yeah,
allowed me to look at and so forth. I definitely have something I think I want to get to, and you know, if you go into this and explain it a bit, I think there's a couple, there's a point I definitely have to make.
Well, I think Ace is bigger than, you know, just a single follow or, you know, episode like this. So I'm thinking we might have to do like a separate thing all about Ace and how just trash he was.
Yeah.
But
well, and you're talking about, you know, yeah, Ace as this other person. So that's my point, is that there's two identities that I kind of want to, or people actually, stars, what have you, previous to Rivers / Ace, one being Bowie.
Okay.
And his changing identity. I mean, he just essentially through his whole career. I mean, he had, you know, all his identities from Ziggy to Thin White Duke, and even though some later weren't as I think well known as the others. I mean, that's just something he would always do. He would for each album practically. Maybe two or three in a row at some point.
Right. But,
change, you know, make himself over and redo and kind of come up with a new way to think about things and be in the world and so forth. Now that's very, you know, in the same vein, it's musical, it's music related here to what Rivers and Ace are. But then the other one, I think it might be even closer tied in a sense to what you're saying, what you're getting at, because like you asked, I wasn't really familiar with this. But so my second celebrity, from the comedy world is, Andy Kaufman.
Oh, yep.
And
obviously
his alternative, his biggest alternative identity. I mean, he certainly had the earlier one, the European Man, which became, what's his name? I can't think about it. Think of it right now. But the one that was on Taxi. But a little bit later, or essentially actually right around the same time, according to Man on the Moon, the wonderful, movie, with Jim Carrey.
Right.
We very much saw in the middle of that, roughly, Tony Clifton. So this was this really, I mean, even crazier, more buffoonish, more of an asshole type character. And it's just this other identity that I think Andy had deep inside him, and he just wanted to get out, and use this character to do some of the things that he, I think he felt too, you know, just, you know, he himself ever acting a little bit like Tony Clifton did would be too over the board and just would not be good for him. But as soon as he was able to put on the guys, I mean, this is like a lot of heavy makeup,
really, right,
prosthetics, right, to get him to look the way this alternative person was. And it even allowed what I believe is his partner at the time, Bob Zmuda, to play the part sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that way they could fool people, thinking try to halfway fool them at least,
right,
thinking they were that Andy really wasn't this Tony Clifton guy.
So
this Ace character to me, from what I think you know, you might say in the future, if we go more in depth into him. It just seems like he's just being this asshole character that he just needed to get out, kind of.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm going to agree to an extent.
Yeah, okay.
I think a lot of Ace is what Rivers has been wanting to say, mm-hmm. but just never had the avenue to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, because because of the stuff that we've read with John Larson's book and, you know, just the other, you know, specials that we've done, he, at this point in his career, he really did not like the Blue Album or Pinkerton, you know. Mm-hmm. And the problem was all of the fans were like, oh my God, it's the best. And Rivers didn't like that. So now this was a way for him to interact with the fans pseudo-anonymously. And let them know that, like, that stuff is trash. You should like the new stuff instead. You know, and so, but, like, initially it was a good thing. Like, it worked out way better than I think a lot of people thought it would. But then eventually it became more and more, you know, Rivers going into his Rivers mode. And he was not very happy with what people thought of Only in Dreams. Sorry, Eric. So at one point he, this was where the infamous gay, gay, gay Disney gay quote mm-hmm. came from. But, so yeah, I think what we'll do at some point is that maybe we'll talk, maybe as we get closer to the end of the album, we'll do kind of like maybe another special episode just about Ace. But down in the clicky clack down at the bottom, I'll put a link to an archive of all of his conversations on the Rivers Cuomo message board or whatever Rivers message board, I think is what it was called. You know, definitely take a look at that. It's so worth it. You know, because it's an interesting time capsule. And I think this whole album is a really interesting time capsule as well, because you have a lot of things that you wouldn't say now, you know. Kind of prevalent in the album, but so a lot of stuff did come, a lot of good stuff did come from this. You know, they were able to rework songs and, you know, change around the music, and the title of the album was actually a fan suggestion as well. It was under the working title of The Black Album, which obviously we use later. So Maladroit was released on May 14th, 2002, which eagle-eared listeners will know that is one day shy of a full year between Green and Maladroit, which, you know, it's a pretty quick turnaround, but then there was the Teal Album and then the Black Album, which was like 23 days, but it's overall regarded pretty well, that it's pretty well done. I mean, it's kind of, they've got some really weird lyrics, which we'll definitely talk about in Dope Nose. But one thing I highly and vehemently disagree with is that somebody said it was one of the worst, or Pitchfork rated it as one of the worst album covers of all time, which I am devastated about that. I love it. It's basic. It's beautiful. Eric, I love it. And your Photoshop of this is fun. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And as you said earlier, it's the lowest selling from the band. But just a couple fun facts before we close out here. It's the first. There's a lot of firsts for this album. It's the first with Scott Schreiner. The first to have a booklet with lyrics instead of just pictures. But the pictures are really fun. And it's the first album to have more than 10 songs. For Weezer, not like in general. Yeah, I think I should clarify that. And also that the first 600,000 albums, or, you know, printing, whatever, you know, CDs printed, were considered first editions and are labeled on the bottom right corner of the back of the album. Do you have your copy of Maladroit mm-hmm. with you right now?
No.
No? Did you look for your fun number? Because I did. I currently have in my hand number 339,209. Wow. But, so that's basically Maladroit. You know, we've got a lot to cover, and, you know, I'm really looking forward to this. I know I've been kind of negative the past couple of albums, but I think that this is really a good turnaround point. So, yeah, You got anything else, Eric?
The one last thing I'd like to point out is that, you know, and it's kind of going pretty close to the beginning of what you were saying. The order in which, you know, that it should have been the follow-up to Pinkerton. My one other thought on that is that, you know, there is definitely this one artist, musician, that, you know, he goes back and forth from one album to the next, being, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yes.
Do you know who that is?
No.
Oh. Beck.
Beck. Yep.
You know, he'll do Midnight Vultures, but then the next album is more low key. I mean, that's a very up tempo, you know, album, and the next one's a little more low key, and then the one after that some more up key, and vice, you know, keeps going back and forth throughout most of his career. I think
after this, this is the last time we really see him, you know, at the low, you know, but. Yeah, it's I'm looking forward to talking about this one. Mm-hmm. You are too, right?
Yeah, I you know, and definitely, you know, listening to it more and more lately, I'm like, you know, man, there's something going on with this, and I can't wait to kind of dig into each of these songs more. For sure. They're not as confusing, you know, the similarities between each song as they were.
Right. For Green. Like Slob is completely different like from American Gigolo. Yeah.
They're all like that.
And the solos are back. Okay, all right. We're not going to get too into it. But anyway, I'm Zach Fracking Smith. You can follow me on Twitter at The Informal Log.
And I'm Eric Nash. You can find me also at Watchmen Minute. We recently went through for the HBO show, all, you know, we recapped all the episodes each week, but you can now, if you binge watch the show, then you can also binge listen to our episodes at Watchmen Minute.
That's the only way I consume media nowadays, is binging. So this podcast, as well as Eric's Almost Famous Minute, is a part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Check us out at pantheonpodcast.com. There's a lot of really good song-by-song podcasts, and also some just, you know, deep digs into music as well, just in general. So check that out, pantheonpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter, at Feels Like Weezer. You can find us on Facebook, Feels Like Weezer. Just look us up. You can send us an email, feelslikeweezer@gmail.com. You can also check out our TeePublic store. Just look up Lucky Mustard as a user. I've also got the clicky down at the bottom. So, is that it?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Are those all the plugs, I think? Yeah. Let's keep wheezing.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.